Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's a company in the business to save our home planet and another company in the business of saving our grasslands. Yvon Chouinard is founder of Patagonia, the company, not the country. He's credited with revolutionizing rock climbing, ice climbing, and even getting dressed for outdoor adventure. Dan O'Brien is founder of South Dakota's Wild Idea Buffalo Company. When you order buffalo jerky from Patagonia Provisions, that buffalo was raised and processed in South Dakota. The two men were in Rapid City recently for the anniversary of Wild Idea Buffalo. They sat down together in the SDPB Black Hill studio for a conversation about dying, really living, and saving the world one grass blade at a time. I want to say thank you, both of you, for sitting down with us together. How often do you get to sit down together and spend time with each other in person?
Oh, not very often at all. Just, sometimes he comes out to Wyoming where I spend the summers, but mainly it's when I come out here to check out the Buffalo Ranch.
Tell me how you met. Dan, let's start with you and tell me how you first sort of came into each other's stratosphere. And how you became business partners, in a sense, yeah.
We knew of each other for quite a while. We have a lot of mutual friends. And probably, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, Patagonia Provisions was really just starting to get going, and they were looking for somebody that could make real grass-fed and healthy jerky. And these guys came out, and we sat down and drove around the ranch a little bit and hit it off, and the rest is history, I guess.
Yvon, tell me why food? Patagonia Provisions, let's talk a little bit about the decision to move in that direction, and then to move in that direction in a way that only Patagonia can as a company.
Well, I've been interested in food all my life, I guess. And, being an entrepreneur, you kind of stick these ideas in the back of your head, and all of a sudden, at some point, they erupt. and I went from being in the, from a blacksmith to being in the clothing business, and then the clothing business being in the food business. And I mean, I'm just kind of an inveterate entrepreneur, and I just can't help myself. And so I start these things and dump them on people. And But now, turns out that it was the best thing I could do, because I think we just changed our mission statement at Patagonia just 5 days ago. And we changed it to, we're in business to save our home planet. Mm. Very simple. And so what does that mean for us? Well, we decided that probably with our resources and the best thing we can do, instead of, endlessly working on symptoms of climate change and stuff like that, is to work on the causes. And probably the best thing we can do is through agriculture. I really believe that if we did agriculture the right way worldwide, we could capture more than all the carbon that we're emitting. And so that's what we're working on.
And Dan, this is a perfect match with what, sort of how you see the world and how you see buffalo and the role in the grasslands. For folks who don't know much about Wild Idea and how the reasons that is a perfect fit, tell us a little bit about your business model at Wild Idea Buffalo.
Well, Wild Idea Buffalo really originated in my need and love for grassland birds, oddly enough. And, I worked as a biologist for many years. And I wanted to kind of found myself in the same position that Yvon found himself in, is that, we're dealing with symptoms here, and, we've got a tremendous crisis on our hands, have had for years. And just a few people back in the 70s had any idea. And fortunately or unfortunately, I think I was one of them. I said, this ain't working. And so we're not gonna deal with the symptoms anymore. We're going to try to go to the cause of what I knew. And I was pretty naive, not really much of an entrepreneur, but I knew that we had to deal with the whole ecosystem of the Great Plains. And from where I started, I didn't have any idea how to do that. And joining up with Patagonia, even in our little way, has opened my eyes to what could be done.
I want to talk more about that in a minute, but first I want to talk about the business, you both as business owners, as entrepreneurs, because Yvonne, you said something about how you started out as a blacksmith, but it's not like you just, kind of grew up and said, I want to be a blacksmith. I mean, you learned the trade of blacksmithing to make the tools that you needed and that other people needed to climb. Talk a little bit about sort of finding your way in business when you never really set out to be in business.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was a mountain climber. I was a falconer, just like Dan is now. And from falconry, I learned to climb cliffs and things like that, and I became a climber. And I'm kind of a craftsman, I guess. And everything I look at, whether it's a piece of cutlery or I look at it and I say, this is crap. I can make something better than this. And so I just can't help myself. And so at the time, the climbing equipment was very crude. Most of it came from Europe. And I just, we were on the cutting edge of climbing, like in Yosemite. We were the first ones to climb these big walls like El Capitan and stuff. And so we needed better equipment than what was available. And so I got myself a forge and a book on blacksmithing, and I learned to make some of this gear, these pitons, and eventually making almost every single piece of, or improving on every single piece of climbing gear. And I sort of, got dragged. I mean, you got to make a living somehow, And I was just making stuff for myself and friends, and then friends of friends want it, and then pretty soon I'm selling these things, and it was organically grown. And woke up one day and I said, oh my God, I am a businessman.
Dan, similar experience? Did you have a day where you woke up and you were like, man, I'm in business?
Yeah, it was in the evening, and I thought it was a nightmare. I really started off just trying to save my little corner of the earth, which was, a few hundred acres. And then, as Yvonne said, you got to figure out a way to make a living. And so we started selling some of the meat. And I honestly don't know what happened, but 20 years later, it's a real business with employees and all the pains that go with it. Although I find it challenging and interesting to run a business, it is an immense amount of work, and there's a lot of things that can go wrong. But I think in my case, it happened to me. I didn't influence it. It just had woke up one morning and Christ, there was 25 people working for me.
Dan, let's stick with you for a minute, because when I look at Yvonne's history and your history, I see another common theme, which is that you have to teach and explain, often through essays. Yvonne was doing it early on in the catalog. You're explaining to people, what is clean eating? What is clean climbing? How do you layer clothing? How do you cook the buffalo? So much of your business model is including telling people, why are we doing it this way? Why does it cost what it costs? Why is it important? Dan, is that something that you embrace as part of your business model, to sort of bring that writing and the essays and the explanation and the teaching into really everything that Wild Idea is doing?
I think that being the kind of entrepreneur that Yvonne and I are, one of the big jobs is education. I think that we both feel that we really are in crisis mode here, and one of the only possible ways to get out of it is to educate people. And that's a tough job. And if it's about food, or if it's about clothing, or if it's about quality, or if it's about conservation, those are all things that most people have no idea about. And we have to get over that hurdle before we even have a chance of getting out of this deal.
Mm. Yvonne, do you feel a sense of urgency for, you know, really throughout your, you know, your business life, but now more than ever? Tell me a little bit about the education or the teaching piece of what Patagonia does, what you're doing with the provisions especially.
Well, you know, somebody said that if everybody thinks you have a good idea, then you're probably too late. And some of the tools that we were making for climbing, our customers didn't even know what to do with them. Like, we revolutionized ice climbing by coming out with better tools. And I had to write a book on how to use this stuff. Mm. And so now, you know, with our mission statement of saving the planet, we have to educate our customers on what we're doing and why we're doing it. And yeah, it's a really important part of it. And, you know, like right now there's a revolution going on in food, in nutrition. And we're only starting to begin to understand what's going on. And it's really, really exciting. I mean, I wake up every day now thinking about these ideas.
Have we lost too much? Do you feel a sense of, because, you know, with recent climate reports and, you know, as people start processing the massive amount of change that needs to happen to address climate change, to address how, you know, through individual actions, corporate actions, governmental actions, Dan O'Brien, do you get overwhelmed at the amount that needs to be done?
Yes. I'm a little skeptical of our ability to solve these problems, to be honest with you. It's hard for me to get up in the morning and put on a happy face. So, yeah, I think it's real tough. And, you know, we're playing in the fourth quarter here, and we're way behind.
Mm. Yvonne, how do you approach that?
Well, you know, I'm kind of a Buddhist about it all. I believe there's a beginning and end to everything. I think, you know, the average lifespan of an empire is 200 years. We're well beyond that. We have a country that can't be managed. You know, the Constitution no longer works for us. It's just, you know, I kind of shrug my shoulders and say, well, you know, I'm going to die. Everything's the beginning and end to everything, and so be it. But in the meantime, I'm going to do what I can so I can sleep at night. And I'm basically a happy person. It's just, you know, I've had enough near-death experiences in climbing where I've gone over the edge. And so I'm not afraid of that, and I'm perfectly accepted the idea I'm going to die. Not many people will accept that, and I try to live my life as if I'm going to die, probably pretty soon, actually.
But okay, I'm going to stop.
Just turning 80.
I'm going to stop you there because some people have that same attitude where they feel like, okay, well, you know, this is what's going to happen to me, and don't act in the way that you do to sort of make things different for a future generation, make things different for the planet. So you have this sense of, you know, an awareness of your own mortality without the accompanying sense of, well, it doesn't matter what I do. Let's have a good time and do whatever we want. Where does that come from?
I think from climbing and kayaking, whitewater kayaking and doing dangerous things. And it's you know, I'm not a religious person, but I'm kind of a spiritual person in that I believe a lot of, you know, American Native American spirituality and I feel like I'm part of nature. And if you really feel like you're part of nature, you see that, you know, everything evolves and dies and devolves, in fact. Some things devolve. It's not just constant natural selection in a positive way, but, and you just, you know, just it's a natural process.
Dan, could you answer or address that same sort of idea of leaving behind at the end of your life, at the end of your efforts? How do you transfer not only a business model, but you know, a way of thinking, a way of living, a way of being in South Dakota, being on the earth, to others, to your, you know, others in your family, your employees, others who read your work and kind of follow who you are and what you do? How do you pass it on to the next generation?
Well, I think passing it on to the next generation is very, very important. I really do believe that people in a native state are pretty, pretty good. And if I can pass my attitudes on to my kids, help my employees understand it, and maybe get some people through the books, I think that's something I can't help doing. Mm. And I think it's important. It's one of the things that keeps me going is, you know, someone will walk up to me and say, geez, I read your book and I never thought about it that way. Boy, I'm good for another month or two. And so that's part of, I think, what we're doing is part of teaching is setting an example. And I think that both Yvonne and myself are trying to set an example where, come on, let's get on the team here. And it's tough because most people don't really understand or care about what we're talking about.
Yvonne, I want to talk a little more about Patagonia Provisions and the sourcing of it and just how, you know, the overall philosophy of how that works. Is it, you know, does it include that educational piece? Does it, you know, is everything responsibly sourced? How do you, give us an overview of that business model, if you would, please.
Well, I mean, we've got a kind of eclectic group of products. It makes no business sense whatsoever. I mean, we got from fish to buffalo to grains and all kinds of weird stuff, but it's all working. But as we developing the business, we're learning a tremendous amount about what's going on with nutrition. Mm. And, you know, there was a study done in 2012 by Stanford University that basically said they found no difference in nutrition between organic and non-organic foods. And then a more recent study by the French just last year said that if you eat organic foods, on the average you'll have about 25% less chance of getting cancer. So eating organically just causes less harm, but it doesn't do you any good other than that. However, if you grow, say, a strawberry regeneratively, now regeneratively is different than just organic. Regenerative means you're giving back to the soil. So, you know, if you buy an organic strawberry from a supermarket, there's a good chance it was grown hydroponically, just with chemicals, or it was grown organically, but all they do between crops is add more liquid fertilizer and soil amendments. Regenerative agriculture puts the nutrients back in through compost and cover crops. And so if you can combine the two, regenerative and organic, then you're making more nutritious food, this has been proven that there's more nutrition in it. You have better tasting food, you're growing topsoil, and you're capturing carbon because you're not doing that deep tilling, which releases all the carbon you've captured. So it's a way of farming that is a win-win-win situation. And I think it's probably the only thing that we're likely to do to combat global warming that is really effective. We're not going to get rid of our cars, and we're not going to, you know, it's hard enough just to put carbon taxes on fuel and energy and stuff. And but this is, I see this as a real positive solution.
Dan, talk, because this is regenerative agriculture, that's the buffalo, that's the grasslands. Talk about the relationship between buffalo and grassland and how grass has really evolved to respond to the actions of the herd.
Well, you said most of it right there. I mean, you would have to
see, I've been listening to you, and I've been reading Dan O'Brien obsessively, so I'm getting it.
You would have to believe in evolution to understand what I'm going to say here. So if you don't, close your ears. But those grasses evolved with the buffalo, a co-evolution situation. And so over tens of thousands of years, those two species, they had a symbiotic relationship. The buffalo need the grass, and the grass need the buffalo. Why does the grass need the buffalo? It has to do with the way they move across the landscape, how they graze, how their feet are shaped, that whole action of them massaging the prairie. The plants on the prairie evolved not only to survive that, but to thrive under those situations. And then, you know, in a matter of 50 years, we come in and get rid of all the buffalo. We bring in a foreign species, sheep and cattle, and that symbiotic relationship is destroyed. And at that point, you start a tropic cascade of species. They no longer have a keystone species, the buffalo. And so that arch, if you use that metaphor, you know, begins to collapse. And in most of the Great Plains, it has already collapsed. Eastern South Dakota is a complete wreck as far as you know, that balance is concerned. And it's a complete wreck because of agriculture. Agriculture, which is basically, the goal of agriculture is to make money. It's subsidized. We've gone crazy with that kind of approach. And with the buffalo and being grazers, we're basically trying to put them back in the position that they have really always been. And it's tough because there are no subsidies in place for buffalo. There's subsidies to tear up ground, to release all that carbon. And, you know, so all of a sudden, instead of having an ecosystem that's species diverse with hundreds and hundreds of species depending on each other, we end up with monocultures with the carbon all in the atmosphere. And, you know, those are the kind of things that are really hard for people to hear. It's hard for some people to understand and to care about, but that's what we're trying to do.
When we talk to people about making change in their personal lives, in you know, what they expect out of their elected officials, in, you know, business models that have been in place for some time, people can be overwhelmed by how hard something will be. And I want to just ask about, both of you have been through times, long stretches of times, where you had almost no money. You were living on very, very little, by choice or by circumstance or by both. What did that, and we'll start with Yvonne, what did those times when things were so lean teach you, and how did that change you as a person that is sort of makes having the conversations about some of the big sweeping changes a little bit make more sense for you because of your personal experience? Does that question make sense?
Well, you know, when I was a young climber and dedicated my whole life to just doing nothing but climbing and living the dirtbag life and, you know, eating cat food from a damaged can outlet in San Francisco. It was self-imposed, and I never thought of it as a hardship or anything. It was just that's what you did to live on the edge of society, and we loved it. It was fantastic, I thought, and I think, you know, if somebody dictated that from now on we can't eat meat anymore, period. Okay, you know, it'd be fine. We get along just fine. So, you know, I don't see it as a hardship. I love change, personally, and I actually don't understand people that hate change. They see it as a threat, where I see it as an opportunity, and so, you know, it doesn't bother me, I guess. But, you know, I think, to add what Dan was saying, you know, it's the buffalo belong here. It's kind of like if you try to grow grapes in Phoenix, you're not going to make very good wine. In fact, if you Cabernet Sauvignon grapes grown in Modesto, California, sell for $800 a ton, you go 200 miles further north, you get as much as $30,000 a ton. The exact same grape, but it's not the same grape. One belongs here and one doesn't. And we just did some studies on our bison here because they're grass-fed to the last second of their lives. By grass-fed, they're probably eating 100 different herbs and grasses and wildflowers and leaves, and every single one has a different nutrients. Like this, you know, different nutrients in spinach than there is in kale. And a lot of buffalo ranchers are doing it completely wrong. They want more marble fat in that buffalo, so they're taking it to the stockyard for the last 3 months of their lives and feeding it GMO corn and soybeans. And, you know, somebody said, you are what you eat. So when you're eating that buffalo, that's you're eating GMO corn and soybeans. And we've done studies on the difference in nutrition between the two products, and ours is off the chart in micronutrients that your gut biome really needs.
Dan, do you want to add to that the humane harvest aspect of this as well, to sort of contrast what, you know, the feedlot model?
Well, first of all, the modern slaughter plant and feedlot is an aberration. I mean, it's anybody that eats meat should go to both of those places and spend an afternoon and see if you still feel the same way. We really can do better than that. It's simply wrong. And I'd like to add this, that if you take a buffalo and you put him in a feedlot, okay, here you are, you know, trafficking in the story of the buffalo, the grass, et cetera, et cetera. But you put him in a feedlot and you end up feeding GMO corn, basically, and what you're actually doing is you're encouraging the conversion of those grasslands to monocultures, because you're buying that subsidized corn to feed those buffalo. You're actually taking a bite off of both ends of that deal, and it is it really is a tragedy and a travesty to have that be the norm in the buffalo business. But it is, because it's the easiest way to make money. Now, we talked a little bit about not having any money, and I've spent a lot of time not having any money. And and to tell you the truth, it's not that great right now. But like Yvonne, I don't really worry that much about it. I'm going to be dead. I haven't really missed any meals. I'll be all right. But I've never owned a new automobile either. That seems to me a little small trade-off for what we're actually trying to do.
Talk a little bit, Dan, we can start with you, about why Yvonne is here in South Dakota, what the weekend events will be, and how you hope to sort of connect with other like-minded people during this weekend.
Well, I think the real reason is he's here is we're going to go pheasant hunting. But I'm just so happy that he is here. It really lends credence to what we're trying to do. And we've got, you know, a couple hundred people showing up. We have our customers from really flying in from all over the country, which I'm amazed at. But to have an icon like this coming to visit Little Rapid City, South Dakota, because of a desire to conserve the grasslands is a huge event. It's a huge event in western South Dakota, and we're just very, very happy to have him here.
Any final thoughts, any things that I didn't ask you that you wanted to make sure to talk about here today? I know you've got a full schedule, so I want to respect your time, but what else needs to be said? Yvonne?
We've been working with some different scientists in trying to figure out nutrition aspects of eating. And we've worked with one guy, a professor at UCLA in California, Emran Meyer, and he has been studying the gut biome, you know, all the bacteria and stuff going on in your gut. And he's coming up with some really interesting stuff. The hunter-gatherers had between, in fact, there's still a few hunter-gatherers in the Amazon and in Africa. There's one tribe in Africa that has between 80 and 100,000 different things to eat on a daily basis. And so they go around, they pick this, pick that, and when you sit down with a steak and a baked potato and a salad, basically you're starving yourself. You're not getting the micronutrients you need to feed that gut. And, you know, our gut is probably only 40% of what the gut biome is only 40% diversity and of what it should be. And there's a connection between taste of a vegetable and the total nutrition. Like if you eat a wild strawberry, I'm convinced that it has more nutrition than one of these gigantic so-called organic strawberries. So the better the taste, the more nutrition. And in wine, it's pretty easy to make metaphor out of wine. Like I just had a bottle of wine the other day that was, the grapes were planted by the Spanish conquistadors in Chile. The roots go down 280 feet. That means they're pulling nutrients up from 280 feet. And it was pretty wild, I must say. And the total nutrition in a vegetable is how deep the roots are. We're working with Kernza, a perennial wheat that was developed by Wes Jackson and the Prairie Institute. The roots go down 15 feet, as opposed to modern wheat, which the roots go down just less than a foot. And we've studied the total nutrient content in that wheat compared to modern wheat, and it's off the chart. And that's an interesting part of the future that I'm really, really interested in, too. And it hasn't really been studied. Mm. And so we're working with a few universities to study that. All the little micronutrients that are important for your health, because without those, without a healthy gut, we're losing our immunities. We've got lots of new modern diseases that never happened before, and so that's my real big interest right now.
Hmm. Dan, any final thoughts on your end?
Well, I guess I'd just say that to back up what Yvonne just said, that diversity is always good, and diversity in the biome is an absolute necessity. And so anything you're doing to limit that diversity is probably the wrong thing to do.
Dan O'Brien, Yvonne Chouinard, thank you so much for making time for the listeners of South Dakota Public Broadcasting today. We really appreciate you coming in.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's our pleasure.